This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. I'm coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network's studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And, oh, we are enjoying the weather. It's dipping just below 90, which is just perfect. Because we have had a long, long run here of 90-degree weather, so it's nice. And my brother, I want to say a special hello to my brother, who is in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. He is a youper, a super-duper youper, and he had snow this weekend. And he's happy. That's why he still lives up there. And I live in Florida because I just couldn't handle the snow anymore, but he loves it. The earlier it comes and the later it stays, he is a happy man. And so the minute the snow arrived, he was all out there and just whirling around out there and enjoying the snow. And so he's hoping it'll last until April. We did. When I was a kid, we always had snow, I think, at Halloween. So it's not unusual. People don't get all worried about global warming in the Upper Peninsula up there. We had snow almost every Halloween when I was a kid. So it's going to be fun for him. He's going to have a great winter. Now, at the bottom of the hour, I am going to be talking to somebody who's really, really, she's written a fascinating book. Her name is Kim Crittson. She is an Academy Award nominated author. She's just a brilliant writer, and she has written a book called Spy in the House of Anais Nin. And it's going to be fascinating to talk to her. She's done amazing research, and the book is just terrific. So I'm looking forward to talking to her at the bottom of the hour. She'll be calling in from California. And so it's really always exciting for me to talk to somebody in California, especially if they wake up on time. I have a number of things I want to talk to you about today because it's funny. For authors, I know all of you get so many emails from people who want to help you. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. But before I do that, I just want to say that Johnny Clark is going to be a guest here on November 26th. And I am really, really looking forward to having him here. He's going to come back. He's just a terrific writer. And I got a lovely email from him telling me how excited he is that, he is just a wonderful person. As a human being, he's a best-selling author of the Vietnam War classic, Guns Up. And while working on his book, Gunner's Glory, he interviewed the Medal of Honor Marine Mitchell Page. And Mitch is the hero of Hasbro Toys designed G.I. Joe, based on Mitch. So there are a lot of things that I want to talk to Johnny about, and I'm looking forward to having him come back to Joy on Paper. And we did a promo for him a while back, and I want to play it again, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit more about his new book.
From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8. It's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life. Dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try. But first, he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do. A little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all, even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You Hope, written by a true American hero. You'll love this book, now available on Amazon. So so get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.
Okay, well, that was one of Johnny's lighter books. Now, the new book is called Walk a Little Farther with Me. He's going to have a book signing, actually, at Haslam's Book here in St. Petersburg on November 24th, and I will remind you of that, but he will be on the program on November 26th, and I'm really looking forward to having him back because he is a hero, and it's always fun. Well, first of all, it's always fun to talk to a Marine, so it's going to be really great to have him here back in the studio with me. Now, you know, it's so funny. I think these things happen in sort of waves. And right now, I love when you, all of you, will send me questions and ask me sometimes before you spend the money, if you should spend the money on something that you get in an email, offers to help you write your book, offers to get your book in front of Hollywood producers, or in this case right now, for one author came to me first with this question about getting your book in front of the libraries, and so I thought, you know, that's an interesting question, and you know, I always do the research, and I said, no, don't send these people money because I don't trust them. And so it's interesting how like a week later I get another email from one of our local authors. So I'm not sure if they're sending out these emails based sort of on geography. They say, okay, we're going to hit all the authors in Florida. They get these writing lists, you know, all authors join different organizations within their state, within their community. So it might be that they are sending them all out to specific areas of the country. But this latest one is suggesting that you immediately send the money so that they can put your name and your book in front of the librarians. And, you know, librarians, this is a big business to get your book in a library. I don't know if most people realize there are over 100,000 libraries in the United States. So if your book is picked up, I mean, you can get a substantial order. You're not going to get all 100,000 unless if you're David Baldacci, you might get an order for 100,000. But generally speaking, if you get an order for 1,000, for an indie author to get an order for 1,000 books at a time, that's pretty good. You feel really happy about it. And so you get this email, and these people are suggesting that you immediately do this because in January, most libraries get their budget, money for the year, and they start spending money. And so there's an urgency. Whenever somebody sends you an email that there's an urgency, you must answer immediately and you must send money immediately, that is sort of a real warning sign that you shouldn't do it. Okay, so and it might be true that they get their budgets in January. I'm not sure that that's true. I'm sure they have budgets all year long. But when you get an email like this and it says immediately send the money, so that they will send your name, they will. It's beautifully worded, actually. It's very clever. And this is what I have discovered with all of these groups and organizations that offer to put your book in front of Hollywood producers. They have beautiful websites, very well done. They look very professional. They have a very good spiel. Most of them are writers themselves, I think, so they... As a matter of fact, in this particular one, he claims to be a writer. Well, he is a writer, but here's the deal. I know most of you don't like to take the time to do the research. This person claims and says he is a seven-figure writer. But most people getting this email would not check into him. The fact is he has written books, and they appear on Amazon. But... let me just say this. If he cannot get even 5 reviews for his books, every book that he wrote, I couldn't find that he had any more than 5 reviews. Well, I would say, I don't think so. I don't think this guy really knows what he's doing. Certainly, why would librarians pay attention to him? He's not Mary Higgins Clark. You know, if Mary Higgins Clark goes to the Librarians Association and the ALA is going to have a convention coming up, and she says, she's invited to speak, and then she says, you know, I really just read this cozy mystery I love so much. I think this author is going to be the next me. Well, then everybody in the room will order that book. But this person is not Mary Higgins Clark or David Baldacci. And I do not believe that they have this kind of connection with ALA. ALA is a big organization and an important organization. But if you want to get through to them, to these people, and they have a convention coming up. It's in, where is it? It's going to be in, I think, it's in Nashville. Oh, it's going to be in Nashville. So it's coming up in November. Well, they have conventions and they have opportunities. But for a single indie author to get noticed by this big organization, it's not easy. If you do want to get noticed, I'm telling you, the only way to get through to them is if you are the. They don't just, you know, listen to somebody who sends them a bunch of emails saying, well, we really like this author. We really like this author. I mean, I could do that. I have more more power. I could write to them. As a matter of fact, you know, I could just send to all of them tapes of the interviews that I hold with the indie authors that I love. And they might actually pay attention. But to somebody who claims to be a seven-figure author, I don't, and is not, and does not have that kind of presence on Amazon or anywhere, I don't think anybody's going to listen. And they want a lot of money, $389 or $369. And so many authors will fall for this. They think, oh, well, this group, this person, and it's also very clever. They have a video, an interview, like a serious interview with somebody, and it's meant to sort of impress you that these people know what they're doing, they have the connections, and they can get right through to these major, you know, groups of librarians, and they will listen to them. And it's not true. Librarians do, as a matter of fact, if you want to be noticed, there are several ways. First of all, Kirkus reviews, good Kirkus reviews, are noticed because the librarians do read them. They also are very impressed by Midwest Book Reviews. If you get a good review from the Midwest Book Reviews, this is good. And a couple other ones that I want to just remind you that, of course, Publishers Weekly, which I talk about all the time, is great. A review from Booklist is wonderful. And then there is a company called, a group called The Horn Book. And it's also, they also do reviews. And it is from these type of reviews, positive reviews from people that are trusted by the librarians, that will get interest in your book. And even so, for an indie author, it's very difficult. They just they're not used to writing a contract for, you know, a purchase order for, you know, 50 books from some indie author. And I know even here in town, local authors sometimes have a real problem getting their own library, a library where they might have been going for their whole lives, to carry their books, because they don't, this is not how it is done. They go through the association, they go through the big guys, and that's why they're big guys. You know, that, so it sort of makes sense. And I just want to warn you, don't send your money to these groups. Really, it's not worth it. You have to get, I know it's all of the authors out there, the indie authors, there are so many of you who have really great, great books. And there are a million books a year are written, and it's hard to get your book out there. But do it the right way. Write the very, very best book that you can, and then work towards getting a reputation for your books through really top-notch reviewers and top-notch groups, because that's a way to get noticed. That's a way, if you eventually want to try to get an agent, if you've been an indie author for a while and you still think, well, maybe an agent would help me, take some of the burden off, although they don't take that much of the burden off anymore. Because as you know, I talk to some of the very top authors in the country, and they are all facing the same problem. They will come to me and they'll say, well, how do I improve my platform? And this is something that even 5 years ago, major authors didn't have to worry about. When I first started the program, I had major authors who were still getting really pushed by the publishers. Nowadays, it's not so easy. It really takes the author to push themselves, and it's not easy. And I know that it's wonderful. I can't imagine anything lovelier than to walk into a library. And I remember my library when I was a kid, McGregor Public Library, which is still in Highland Park, Michigan. Unfortunately, it's closed up. They covered the windows with plywood. They're letting the roof rot away. And the books are still inside. The books that I loved, I spent my whole childhood reading almost every book in that library. I mean, literally, almost every book in that library. I started in the children's room, went around the entire children's room, and I was still very young and 11 years old, and I started I moved straight into the adult rooms and up in the stacks, and I started, and I went, I was very methodical in those days. I started at A's, and I just went around, and so it's sad for me to think of that library being shuttered up and being allowed to rot away, but there are many times that you've been in a library that, you know, it's your library and it's still there, and it would be so nice to see your book on the shelf. But indie authors have a double problem. One, the books are paperback, and libraries still, I mean, they really prefer hardbacks because, you know, they last. It's difficult. You're going to go through the expense, and then so many people check out the book. Paperbacks just don't last, so they want hardbacks, which is one more knock against indie authors, and it's just difficult. But don't waste your money. There's better ways to get traction with $389 than to try to send it to somebody who is really, I believe, just it's phony. Nobody's going to notice these people, and it's another warning. And I'm sure they will be sending out more emails and doubling the effort to try to get people all excited that it's coming to the end of the year and you must act before December 31st or no library will ever carry you as long as you live. So just take it, you know, with a grain of salt, and work harder on getting your book noticed by the people that count. And those are, again, to remind you again, I'm going to say the names. Midwest Books, Literary Journal, Kirkus, really great. Publishers Weekly, Book List, of course. The Horn Book, School Library Journal, and Library Thing. Those are all excellent places. Check them out. See if you can get a good review. And that is the way to do it. Now, we're going to take a commercial break, and when I come back, I am going to have a really great author on, and it's really exciting that I'm going to be talking to Kim Crittson, an Academy Award-nominated writer.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with the Z, and I am back, and I am just waiting. Ed, has she called in yet? No. Okay, well, we're waiting. We always wait for people from California. It takes them a little while to wake up over there, and so I'm just looking forward to talking to her in a few minutes. So she's going to call at 11:30, I think. So meanwhile, I have a few minutes. I want to talk about, I have a wonderful author coming on soon, and I just love her. This is, I think, her third or fourth time, and it's Rachel Renee Russell, and she's going to be on the program to talk about the Dork Diaries. I don't know if you haven't read the Dork Diaries, you want to read them. They're just so, if you have any young people in your life, these books are delightful. And, you know, when, they're done in, how can I say? They're done diary fashion. They're diaries. So they're just different typeset. You know, diary looks like handwriting or hand printing, which actually, it's so funny. When I open up the book and they're hand printed, some font they use, and it's like they copied my handwriting, because that's how I write. I write very neatly, and I print, actually, because I've always printed, and so I print exactly like in the book. And it's funny. So it's when I'm reading, I say, "Oh, that looks like I actually did it," and I'm so excited that Renee is going to be back on the program again, because she is. She and her daughter, who does the illustrations, they have just such a wonderful, funky attitude, just a joy in, you can see in the writing that Rachel just loves the subject. And she just has so much fun with these books. And when her daughter started drawing and taking over the illustrations, she just does a beautiful, beautiful job. And so it's always fun to talk to Rachel. And again, she's going to be on soon. That's 22nd, I think, yes. And so I'm eager to be talking to her. And this is an example. You know, this is a young adult series, and I think it's the 14th in this series, and 14th in this book series, Dork Diaries, which is, I mean, she's sold so many of these books, and it, you know, when she got the idea to write in a diary fashion, using a font, you know, a font that looks like handwriting, and with black and white drawings. At the time, people said, well, that's silly. That's not going to go. But, you know, sort of those mid-age kids, 11, 12, 13, 14, they love these. And I also recommend to parents, when you if you have a child in that age range, to read the book yourself, because it gives you something to talk about and with them, because she always touches on important things like bullying and being kind, and because this one is called Tales from a Not So Best Friend Forever, and she discusses these things. So Rachel Renee is absolutely terrific. But now I am going to be talking to somebody. Ooh, this is exciting for me. This is really exciting. I think you're. This is really great. Kim Crittson is.
Hi,
Kim. You are so fantastic. Academy Award nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay and Writers Guild Award. It's a thrill to talk to you, Kim.
Well, thank you. It's a thrill to talk to you, too.
Well, you know, Kim from L.A. sent me Kim, who is in L.A., and so it's just wonderful that I get to talk to you about this truly amazing book, Spy.
I'm so glad you like it. That makes me so happy.
Spy in the House of Anaïs Nin is absolutely terrific.
Oh, God, thank you so much. It was a labor of love, and I'm so happy that you like it. That excites me so much.
Well, it was so wonderful when I got the book, and I said, Spy in the House of... Well, and of course, I've seen pictures, so I was thinking, you know, it's such a thrill, you know, when an author can actually work in the area where the person they're writing about lived. And you did that, and you've been there, and you now, of course, you're part of this entire whole Anaïs Foundation, and it's quite impressive.
You know, it was amazing to work in her home. It was a real pilgrimage for me. As I was years ago, I was working on a master's thesis about Anaïs Nin, and I was thrilled beyond words to get to meet her second husband, Rupert, and go to the home. But then I find that in recent years, I've been working hard in her home amongst her possessions, you know, digging out papers, going through drawers and closets and cabinets.
Gives me chills. Oh.
It really feels like a pilgrimage in which I'm digging up artifacts, you know, and learning about someone's private life through their papers is just something. It's been really amazing.
Oh, I know the feeling that you have, because when I was young, I was obsessed with Jane Austen. And I started saving my money from a paper route when I was a kid. I always intended, and I was born in northern Michigan, where, you know, Jane Austen is not a big thing up there, but I became obsessed. And when I was 21, I moved to England and bought a house not far from where Jane Austen was born.
I totally understand your motivation. I get it completely.
Isn't it wonderful when a character, an author takes over and they become sort of a character of your life then?
Oh, that makes so much sense to me that you did that, because you wanted to get close to the action. You know, she's long dead, but in your consciousness, she's a living, breathing influence on you. So I completely understand that.
Well, how did you get this gig? I mean, this is like, you're an actress, you're a Hollywood writer, and then you get something like this. I don't know if how it sort of fell into your hands, or it possessed you, or it's one of these things that's sort of meant to be.
Well, when I was 20 years old, I was a literature student, and I was living in the Los Angeles area. I stumbled upon Anaïs Nin's childhood diary in a tiny little bookstore, and I had never heard of her. I did not know how to pronounce her name, but this childhood diary, started when she was 11 years old, was so beautifully written and so profound that I spent all of my lunch money for the week to buy it, and that really addicted me. So I remember going to some of my professors and asking if they had heard of her. And at the time, she wasn't so much in vogue anymore. She had been a real guru to, especially to young women in the 60s and 70s, because she was championing this idea that a woman and a woman's private life, a woman's emotional life, a woman's diary was an important thing. And that, you know, hadn't really, in the world of literature, you know, it had been dominated by men and dominated by the novel. You know, everybody was studying Hemingway and Fitzgerald, who are absolutely wonderful. But to have a female who, by the way, did not have a high school diploma, who had been abandoned by her father, so she had a single mother, which was a very rare thing in the 20th century. So these all seemed like strikes against her. And a child, you know, just a child's diary, it seems like it would be something so unimportant. But I was thumbing through this diary in this bookstore and thinking, my God, this 11-year-old girl is a fantastic writer, so insightful. Her writing is so beautiful. I bought the book, and that just started me on this path of reading, then sequentially reading all of her diaries, and then getting more and more, at the time, I was in getting a master's degree in literature and psychology. I was living then in Texas, but I flew out to meet her second husband and to look at her house, and he showed me some of the private documents, you know, in the house, and somehow I just kept going. In spite of the other things I ended up doing, like the Hollywood writing thing and the acting deal and all that, I just kept going with my interest in Anna East. And eventually the family who inherited, Rupert's family inherited her estate. But they have such a mountain of papers that they really needed someone who was a bit of an expert at that point in Anna East Neen to come in the home and help them sort through. So in doing that, I got to do all kinds of, I guess it's archival work, but it felt like I was an archaeologist, you know?
Well, I want to sort of place my listeners in the location, because when we talk about Spy in the house itself is so outstanding, and it really says so much about her too. So let's talk about the house and how you were there. I get so just thrilled thinking about it.
Well, the house is in Silver Lake, Los Angeles, and Silver Lake is a part of Los Angeles where it just so happens now a lot of writers live there, a lot of artists, but it's a hilly neighborhood and has palm trees. It's a little bit on the east side of Los Angeles, but on a really clear day, one can see the ocean from these hills. And this home that was built for Anna East and her second husband, Rupert, was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright's grandson, Eric Lloyd Wright, who happened to be the half-brother of Rupert Pohl, her second husband. He was very young at that point, had not actually designed many things, but he designed this small house to be built in Silver Lake. And, of course, at the time it wasn't a heavily populated area, so they were able to buy the land. But the house has Anna East written all over it. She was a person who was a very modern person. And so she, by the time the house was built in 1960, she had such an incredible sense of style. And she was not an elitist at all about material things. She was modest about material things, but her sense of style was incredible, so that she could do amazing, like, just to give you an example, There were periods where she didn't have a lot of money, so she got, you know, those little tiny little colorful umbrellas that they put in alcoholic beverages, the pretty little umbrellas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so just to give you an example, she would put those little umbrellas all through her hair to make an exotic hairstyle in, say, the 1950s. She had a way of just creating beauty and creating an ambiance. So this home, it's a modest home, but it was built in kind of the Japanese style. So it's very simple, very clean, with a little sand garden inside, very tiny little sand garden, because at that point, as this house was being built in the late 50s, it was finished in 60, she was very interested in Asia, in Japan. She was traveling when she could. And so she wanted it built in the Japanese style. It has a very small but beautiful pool in the backyard that she wanted painted black, so that it looks, you know, it's very kind of mysterious and simple. And it did have willow trees around it at one point when she was still living. I've read the letters that she exchanged with Rupert Poole when she was away from the home and he was working on it, and they were discussing colors, and she wanted a lot of purples in this home. They bought some beautiful wood that had a beautiful wood grain, and then they used a purple stain over the wood. So the whole thing is so Anna East of that period. Honestly, every home she had reflected who she was at the time. So she went through a period in the 1920s where she was fascinated with the Moorish world, the Moors, and so she bought furniture that she thought was Moorish and designed the entire home in that style. And then after she and her husband Hugh Geiler lost their money, they weren't super wealthy by any means, but he was a banker, and he lost all of his savings in the crash in 29. They had to move to more modest digs outside of Paris at that point. So they rented a home that was 200 years old. It was not in the best shape, and they fixed it up to the best of their ability. And she describes in great detail how she painted each room in different colors. So she really had this way of creating beauty around her. It's one of the things I love best about Anna Eastman.
Well, it's one of the really remarkable things in literary in the whole world of literary geniuses, that she kept writing from the age of 11. Over 50 years of diaries, and you've read them all, although you probably,
yes,
you're still finding things?
Yes, well, there are more things to find all of the time. Yes, she began writing at age 11 on this boat as she was, the family was leaving Spain, and they were coming to Ellis Island in New York, and she kept writing until she died in 1977. So it was from 1914 to 1977, so that's a lot of diary entries, and many, many thousands and thousands of pages. I've read, gosh, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of not only, obviously, the published diaries, but the raw diary pages. And it's incredible how beautiful her, you know, her handwriting. I know with my diary, a lot of us keep diaries. My diaries include an awful lot of, you know, scratching things out and bad handwriting and, you know, that sort of thing, but not hers. Hers are beautifully written, gorgeous handwriting. Her diary was really what she called her habit. You know, she said that it was the thing that kept her going, that allowed her to live. And I've come to the conclusion, many of us keep diaries, I've come to the conclusion that she was very visionary with this diary writing, because we now respect diary writing. In fact, you know, via the internet, we keep a kind of public diary
with our social media, with, you know, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. These are kind of public diaries of a sort. And she, in fact, as she was still living back in the 60s and 70s, she wished for a, quote, half quote, cafe in space, unquote. And I think that's a really beautiful, poetic term for the internet, you know, or for social media. She was quite visionary in understanding that we needed to keep connected to one another. And, you know, you and I have connected, you know, with various writers through books, which is a beautiful thing. But she foresaw that maybe we'd find connections through other means in the future, and we have.
So the original blogger.
Yes, absolutely, the original blogger.
Well, I'm going to say a few names, and then you tell us, because, you know, I wish I had a whole hour with you, but I want just so people understand the depth of her relationship with so many important people and important authors and important people in general over the years. And of course, she was always so insightful. And so let's just talk about a few people that others will recognize. Well, we'll start with Henry Miller.
Henry Miller, when she met him, he was a vagabond. I mean, practically a hobo living in Paris. He was from Brooklyn. He was married to this very exotic woman named June. So I'm sure most of us have heard of the Henry and June. He was a wannabe novelist and came to Paris with almost no money whatsoever. When they met, it was just kind of a fluke that he was invited to her home for a lunch, and neither one of them thought anything of this. But when they met, there was such an electrifying coming together of two like minds, and it seemed so strange that this very lovely and demure banker's wife, who was, writing a diary privately that no one knew about, met this wannabe novelist. They had so much to talk about, and she ended up really championing his writing, as he did hers. She helped him get Tropic of Cancer published, and they really believed in one another all their lives. He called her the starry being. He thought that she was a magnificent writer. And then later, when her diary was published, he was a huge champion of her diary. It did turn out that they had a secret romance, and we didn't know about that for a long time, because when the Diary of Anna Eastman, Volume 1, was published in the mid-60s, starting with that period when she knew Henry, she talked about their friendship in the diary, but she edited out the actual romance because she did not want to hurt her family. And we found out later about their relationship with the unexpurgated part of the diary. That edited part was released in the 80s, and that's Henry and June. So she had an amazing relationship with him, and then was very inspired by his wife June as well.
Okay, well, that's a fascinating story, the whole Henry and June story. Now let's mention a few others. Gore Vidal,
the grandson of a senator, a very patrician young man she met in the 40s when he was 20 years old and she was 42 years old. He had finished a novel, and he was destined for this successful career. He's a very, very, very intelligent person. It looked that he was going to be a very successful writer. When they met in the 40s, they just instantly adored one another, and very quickly it appeared that they were almost acting like jealous lovers, though there was this 22-year age difference. They had what appeared to be an incredible friendship, but it's disconcerting that later, after she died, and everyone knows, you know, Gore Vidal became the great wit, you know, and he's very famous for his battle, his big battles with, say, Norman Mailer and Buckley, William Buckley, and you know, these are, one can find these on YouTube. He was incredibly articulate and got and could really hold his own. But I was disconcerted when he criticized Anna East's name so vehemently in his memoir Palimpsest, and his reasons for attacking her seemed sort of bogus to me. I thought that there must be some sort of story behind that. So I went digging. And I did find, indeed, I found letters. And he misrepresented their relationship. So I write about that in my book, about the true story behind his bitterness toward Anna Eastning.
Well, there were a couple other... I'm running out of time. I hate when I run out of time. I could keep you for another hour. Forget any show after me. I wish I could just keep going. Edmund Wilson.
A famous editor.
I was surprised.
A famous editor who had been married to Mary McCarthy. And he was very much of the establishment, and the literary establishment. Anna East was not of the literary establishment. She, during the time she knew Edmund Wilson, was a writer of very surrealistic stories, and she was very underground. She had a tiny little cult following during the 1940s. He was a king of the literary establishment. And so he ended up writing a review of her book of short stories called Under a Glass Bell. And he wrote that they were, you know, magnificent little stories, lovely little stories. Now, this was the first real approbation she got from the literary establishment. They became friends. They were such different people, and they did have a little romance.
Yeah, so, that one really surprised me. Well, you know, I don't have much time. I do want to say I like this quote of hers: "Good things happen to those who hustle." Right? Is it a real quote?
I don't think it is.
I wish it was.
Yeah, I don't believe that one is a real quote. There are a couple quotes floating around that are not actually mean quotes, but there are so many that are, that she's known for these beautiful pithy little quotes. I don't believe she ever used the word hustle.
Yeah, I was wondering. That's why I wanted to ask you if that was one of hers, because unfortunately I have to hustle here, and I do want to tell everyone that they should get this book. Kim Crichton, and Spy in the House of Anna Nin. And tell us, where can people find you? You have, of course, you're with the foundation, and where else can people find you?
Well, the book is on Amazon. They can get the book or Kindle, and the Audible is going to be out in a day or two. If they want to find me, I do have a Facebook present. So and also I'm running an Instagram for the Anna Eastman Foundation. What I'm doing is I'm putting up photographs of Anna East that I've dug out of her home, some of which haven't been seen in forever.
Well, so she's just to look at her, she was quite incredible beauty.
Oh, absolutely. All through her life, the beauty.
And I must say that your Facebook photo is gorgeous too. So thank you. I want to add that whoa, that's a beautiful photograph of you there on your Facebook page. So people can find you. And Academy Award nominated. And it's just an honor to talk to you. And perhaps I could have you back. What's your birth date again?
My birthday?
No.
Oh, her birthday. Her birthday is February 21st.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll have you back for her birthday and we can talk more. How about that?
Oh, I would love that.
I'm going to put you on my calendar. I will let Kim of L.A. know, and you're going to come back, and we're going to talk for more about your book and about the fabulous work you've done to keep this story alive.
Oh, It's been my joy to keep the story alive, and such a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay. Well, bye-bye now, Kim, and I will be in contact, okay?
Fantastic. I'd love it. Okay.
Bye-bye
now. Okay.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye. All right. Oh, yeah, let's have her back. This is, you know, if you have, I was just so shocked when I read the book, and I don't know, I never had an idea of Edmund Wilson doing. He was really quite an interesting character. Anyway, so that was fun. That was fun to talk to her, and I think that it'll be fun to have her back here in February. We'll talk more about Anaïs. It's pronounced Anaïs for all of you people who see that name. And I, as Kim said, when I was young, and I also started reading her when I was a teenager, and I didn't know how to pronounce it. It's because it's spelled A-N-A-I-S, and I got it all wrong too. But it is Anaïs Nin, and the book is really great. Spy in the House of Anaïs Nin, and it's available on Amazon. You can get it, and enjoy it because it's rather I don't know. It's It covers so many areas of history. I mean, when you have diaries that you write for over 55 years, wow, it's amazing. All of you, I've told you before that one of the joys, you know, of life is to see your words are paper, but and she really took it. And when you read her book, the one that starts when she was 11, you're just blown away. You cannot imagine that an 11-year-old can write so beautifully and so thoughtfully and so deeply. And so, but, you know, this is one of the things of that you have to start doing. If you want to be a writer, you have to write. And she obviously had the right idea. Because, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky to hear those words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture. And I have a feeling that this book, which is called Spy in the House of Anaïs Nin, will be, well, Kim is already an Academy Award nominated scriptwriter, so I think she'll do another one, and this time based on her own book, and it's going to be a terrific film. Fascinating, fascinating story that covers 55 years of the literary world, and she even had an affair with John Steinbeck, which really, that blew me away too, because John Steinbeck, I don't know, never appealed to me particularly. Anyway, it's interesting. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to get in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye.